I'm no sports junkie, but I came across a bit of news from the sporting world this last week. Golfer John Rahm won the US Golf Open. Apparently, that was a pretty big deal. And reflecting on his win, he had the following to say. He said, "I'm a big believer in karma. And after what happened a couple of weeks ago, I stayed really positive, knowing good things were coming." Whether John Rahm has a settled belief in karma or not, I do not know. Perhaps it was just one of those comments people tend to make when they're in the heat of the moment, when they're caught up in the moment. But in any case, some people do interpret significant events of their lives as a result of karma. They do subscribe to the idea that if your intentions and deeds are good, good things will come your way, like winning the US Open. When we look at Ruth's story, I want us to see something completely different. I actually want to go in a completely different direction with you. I want us to see something completely different, that Ruth's pursuit of marriage and good fortune was not the work of karma, but of true Christian faith. Ruth's good fortune is the result of true Christian faith. We'll see this by identifying at least five characteristics of true and lively Christian faith. There are five characteristics that I'd like to share with you this morning of true Christian faith. Faith is, firstly, intentional. It is dedicated, it is humble, it is effective, and faith has the stamina to wait. Those are the five things that I'd like us to think about this morning. And hopefully, in seeing this, it will help us to exercise true faith more faithfully. It will help us to understand what it is we are to do and how we are to exercise our faith. And to get our minds engaged, let's just remember where we left off in chapter 2. Naomi and her daughter-in-law, both widows, had returned to the Jewish homeland where they discovered two surprising possibilities. Two surprising possibilities. One was that there was a potential redeemer there for them. A close relative, and one who could lawfully redeem land once belonging to Naomi's family. It was lawful for this redeemer to redeem land on behalf of Naomi. But also, secondly, that the redeemer may also become a lawful husband and reestablish the family line. So these are the two possibilities that exists for Naomi and Ruth. There is someone who could reclaim their land and someone who could reestablish their family line, given that they were widows. But above all, Ruth, a foreigner, remember, a Moabite, not an Israelite, a foreigner, had truly placed her faith in the God of Israel. As Boaz, the potential redeemer, said of her, "The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." So this is the main theme that we'll be tracing today. Ruth has come to live among Israel in faith, and now we come to see what it means for Ruth to live by that faith. She has come to live in Israel in faith, and she is now shown to live by faith in chapter 3. Taking this approach will, of course, help us from turning this story into a weird tale of a floozy gold digger looking to get hitched, right? I mean, you read this just in itself, and it seems weird. It seems like someone poor is trying to get shacked up with someone rich. That's not what the story is about. Throughout, we'll be looking for evidence of Ruth's faith in action. We want to see what it looks like tangibly. So let's begin. In the opening verses, Naomi, the mother-in-law, crafts a plan, cobbles together a plan to unite Ruth and Boaz. So from the very outset of the chapter, there is intentionality in the air. And this is the first characteristic of faith that I'd like us to think about. Faith is intentional. Look at verses 3 to 5 once more. Naomi directed Ruth, "Wash therefore and anoint yourself, and put on your cloak and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. But when he lies down, observe the place where he lies. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do." And Ruth replied, "All that you say I will do." Do you recognize intentionality here? It is a plan and it is being intentionally pursued. I bring this up because sometimes people think of faith as simply another word for passivity. That faith and passivity are synonyms. That faith is simply an inactive hope, a motionless thought, a well wish. But consider Naomi and Ruth, widows who have come to trust in God's covenantal care for them. They've seen God's care expressed in their scriptures, and now they hope to see that care embodied among the people who live faithfully by these scriptures, where it is detailed, if a man dies having no children, his brother must marry the widow and raise up children for his brother. This is one expression of God's covenantal care for widows in ancient Israel. Naomi, along with Ruth, went after this intentionally by faith. They actively pursued what God had promised them in his word. So faith is characteristically intentional. Consider some of the things that Jesus has promised you. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Do you remember these things that Jesus promises you? An expression of true faith strongly gravitates towards the kingdom of heaven, towards satisfaction in God's rightness, toward a merciful disposition. All this among the other things that God has promised to us in the scriptures. I mention this because I want you to know faith is not simply passive. It is intentional. It goes after the things of God. It seeks them out. It wants them. So faith is intentional. Secondly, faith is also dedicated. In order to recognize this, we need to appreciate a couple of historical details. Remember, Ruth was at this time a young, unmarried foreigner, sent to Boaz under the cover of darkness, in the proximity of men who had clocked off work for the day with a couple of drinks. If discovered, if Ruth was found out in that situation, there was conceivable risk of unwelcome sexual advances. Scholar Leon Morris helps us to get a sense of this, See, it's an ancient Near Eastern, an ancient Near East. Immoral practices at harvest time were by no means uncommon, and indeed appear to have been encouraged by the fertility rites practiced in some religions. This is the ancient Near Eastern world. So there were all kinds of risks to a single woman out on her own under the cover of darkness. But remember, Ruth isn't there to flirt with the boys. She is there with dedicated faith to meet Boaz. And by now she knows Boaz's character. She knows that Boaz is not a player. He doesn't sleep around. He's not the kind of guy that would take advantage of her. In fact, what the Bible does tell us about Boaz is that he is a generous and a worthy man. And Ruth has come to know this about Boaz. And she has come to entrust herself to him and him alone. Faith has this singular dedication. In Christian terms, we speak of it as faith in Christ alone. It's a tenet of our faith that we believe that salvation comes by God's grace through faith in Christ alone. So Christians are those who have come to put their faith in Jesus alone, having learned his character, and that he is altogether trustworthy. He is the ultimate worthy man. So faith has dedicated this way, singular in its focus. But we also learn that faith has a certain posture. Like someone who might throw their hands in the air with excitement when they see an old friend, or someone who might kneel at their bedside when they pray. Faith too takes on a certain posture. It takes on a humble posture. While there are a lot of cultural factors in this episode that may seem strange and unfamiliar to us, consider Ruth's position with Boaz, verses 7 to 8. She came softly and uncovered his feet and lay down. At midnight, the man was startled and turned over, and behold, a woman lay at his feet. That probably sounds quite strange, right? I don't know what exactly the dating practices of the ancient world was, but honestly, that does sound a little strange to us, doesn't it? To modern ears, we're like, what do we do with this? You know, what's going on? What are these ancient customs and arrangements? We may speculate, but we'd be blind to miss the obvious. We'd be blind to miss the obvious that without sexualizing the encounter, Ruth made strong indication that she desired Boaz to be her husband. He couldn't miss the point. Ruth is there because she wants to marry him. Her intentions are made clear, and we need not read anything sexual into this encounter. And she made these intentions clear by positioning herself humbly at his feet. So all I want to say about this is that faith readily takes a humble, submissive posture toward the Redeemer. In practical Christian experience, this is most keenly observed in our posture towards Jesus and his word. Is our posture humble? Is there a humble willingness to believe and do as he teaches us in his word? Even the hard parts. especially the hard parts. Even the parts that will make us stand out like a sore thumb in the coming decades. The parts for which we'd be labelled outdated and irrelevant. Like believing that God created two fixed genders. And that racial envy and pride is a sin and not a virtue. Think about that. Are you willing to believe these things that God teaches us in His Word? Will you be humble towards His Word and receive it? Faith humbly submits itself to the Redeemer and accepts Him at His Word. That is faith's most natural posture. Faith's posture is naturally humble. A fourth characteristic of faith is, of course, its effectiveness. We see this in verses 10 to 11. Boaz said to her, "May you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness greater than the first, in that you have not gone after young men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you ask." If this is really just a story about a floozy looking to get hitched by someone to someone rich, it would be easy for us to imagine that Ruth got her wishes because she managed to seduce Boaz into an agreement of sorts. That this is just seduction. Boaz has become compliant because of her good looks and her batting her eyelids. That somehow Ruth has made Boaz putty in her hands. This is, of course, a terrible misunderstanding of the chapter. Note, nowhere in this chapter are we given details of Ruth's physical attractiveness. We don't know if she was a stunner or not. We're not told. And another controversial point is that Ruth is evidently much younger than Boaz. He refers to her as his daughter. There's an age gap. Trying to read Boaz's willingness to do all that Ruth asked of him as a matter of infatuated lovers is not evident in the text itself. Instead, Boaz's gracious acceptance of Ruth is located in something far better. His willingness to have Ruth is located in something far better than mere physical attractions. It is rooted in covenant faithfulness. Let me explain. Remember, Ruth had come to Boaz for one reason. He is a potential redeemer. That's why she's there at night at his feet. As we mentioned, a redeemer was someone who could rescue and reclaim a widow's land and lineage, her family and her farm. He could do that legally, lawfully, as the Old Testament entitled him to do, indeed obligated him to do. Men in the covenant community had both the privilege and the responsibility to fulfill this law. Something Naomi, through Ruth, hoped Boaz would indeed do. And because she trusted or had faith that this covenant provision would be fulfilled, she was rewarded with immediate willingness from Boaz. "I will do all you ask, Ruth." Why? Because he is a faithful covenant keeper. and so her faith proved effective. She went and she received because she went in faith. This is such a clear reflection of what we have, of what we Christians have in Jesus. Being the true and better Boaz, the ultimate Redeemer who rescues and reclaims us. Jesus is, in a sense, bound by covenant to redeem those who come to him. If we come to him in faith, he is in some measure bound by covenant to redeem us. He must redeem us. He cannot and he must not do otherwise if he is to be regarded as a faithful keeper of God's law and covenant. And this is such good news for you and I. Jesus cannot and must not turn you away if you come to him in faith. It is really good news for you. Jesus does not commit himself to our plight because we're good-looking people or we've batted our eyelids at him just right. That's not why he commits himself to our plight. His commitment to us is founded in his voluntary willingness to faithfully keep covenant, to do as he promised to do, to forgive all who come to him, and to secure their future. Faith. Faith is the only instrument that effectively draws this willing response from Christ. Faith is the sole instrument which draws this kind of response from Christ. Not good works, faith. Faith alone draws the willing response from Christ, as Ruth drew a similar response from Boaz also. Lastly, I would also like us to see that faith must wait. Faith must wait. Though the Redeemer is willing, we do not see everything about our redemption immediately. Look at verse 18. By this time, Ruth had returned to Naomi, and she discussed what little yet positive interaction she's had with Boaz. But for now, Ruth has to wait. Naomi replied, "Wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out. For the man will not rest, but will settle the matter today." And there the curtain drops. You have to come back another time for the encore. But for now the curtain drops on the scene with the announcement that Ruth must wait. Much of our lives are like this, isn't it? Much of what we experience in faith is a waiting, a longing, a desire. Much of what we hope for in God is yet to come. We long for full freedom from our sinful thoughts and words and deeds, and yet we must wait. We long for the resurrection of these dying bodies, and yet we must wait. We long for the knowledge of the glory of the Lord to cover the earth as the waters cover the sea. And yet we must wait. We long for Jesus to triumph over the final enemy, death. And yet we must wait. The Apostle Paul penned these words about our waiting. We ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit grown inwardly as we wait eagerly for adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies. Isn't that how you experience Christian life? In faith, you groan inwardly because you're waiting. You're waiting for the full realization of your adoption and redemption. Faith enables us to wait with this kind of anticipation. Faith has that kind of stamina, knowing that some of our longings will only be satisfied on the other side of heaven. So here's where I'll close. The chapter illustrated some characteristics of true biblical faith. We have come to see that Ruth and Naomi had come to Israel in faith. Now we see what it means for them to live by that faith. And we see this in the characteristics of faith. Faith is intentional. Faith is dedicated. Faith is humble. Faith is effective. And faith enables us to wait for God and future fulfillment. Each of us, myself included, are encouraged to examine our faith in light of this and to learn from this. Perhaps even to be more intentional in our pursuit of the promises of God. To be more dedicated to Christ alone. And more humble toward God and His Word. And yet for others, you may have never considered faith as an act of trust in God. Would you be open to consider this lesson from the passage? Would you be willing to act in faith toward the God who raised Jesus from the dead and has made it known that there is salvation in no one else? For there is no other name under heaven given among men by which we must be saved. Amen.